Welcome back, everyone. Our first speaker this afternoon is Rob Speckens. Rob.
There's currently no consensus about what is the correct interpretation of quantum theory. But there is a core of the theory that everyone essentially agrees upon. So if one has a description of an experiment in essentially classical terms, then you can predict the statistics of outcomes of measurements in that experiment. So for example, if I consider this sort of experiment, one proposed by John Bell, then I'm preparing a pair of particles in an entangled state. I'm taking the particles off to distant locations, and I'm subjecting each one to one of a set of possible measurements on each wing. So S labels the setting on the left, T the setting on the right, and X and Y are just labels for the outcomes. So the quantum formalism tells me what the relative frequencies of the four possible joint outcomes I might get are for each of the four possible choices of settings. And here's an example of such statistical data. Now, some scientists believe that this is all any scientific theory should do. It should simply provide an algorithm for computing the statistics of outcomes of measurements. And this is what I'm going to call the purely instrumentalist position on the interpretation of quantum theory. Okay, and I want to argue against the adequacy of this position to begin with. And so I'm going to do that by noting a paradox from statistics known as Simpson's paradox. So the situation here is you have a drug trial, and you've got a population of individuals with some illness, and you administer a drug to some fraction of that population, and you just compute what the rate of recovery is. And you happen to find in this case that the rate of recovery for those who got the drug is greater than for those who didn't. And so at this stage, you might say, well, probably this drug is effective for treating this illness. But then you notice that if you look at the subpopulation of men, then the inequality goes the other way. The rate of recovery is lower for those who got the drug than for those who didn't. And you find the same thing for the women. The rate of recovery is lower for those who got the drug than for those who didn't. So if you naively try to interpret this in a causal fashion, it seems paradoxical. It would seem that if you're a man or a woman, you shouldn't take the drug. But if you're a member of the general population, you should. And obviously, that makes no sense at all. So let me show you the kinds of statistics that can lead to this situation. So here's some statistical data. 300 men were administered the drug, 180 recovered. That's a 60% recovery rate. Whereas 100 did not get the drug, 70 recovered. That's a 70% recovery rate. So it's better to not get the drug. For the women, 100 got the drug, 20 recovered versus 300 who didn't and 90 recovered. That's a 30% versus 20% recovery rate. So it's better not to get the drug. But if I take the totals, the total number of people who got the drug is 400, and 200 recovered. That's a 50% recovery rate. Whereas over here, again, 400 people didn't get the drug, but only 160 recovered, 40% recovery rate. So surely, sure enough, overall, it's better to not get the drug. So as an instrumentalist, one would say, well, all any scientific theory should do is provide such data tables and predict what's going to occur in this sort of experiment. But it's clear that in this situation, such a scientific understanding of the drug trial is not sufficient, because it doesn't answer the question that we really want to have answered here, which is, if you have this illness, should you take the drug or not? It's really not clear, looking at the statistics, what you should do. So what you really need to do is look underneath the statistics and ask, what's the causal mechanisms? What's a causal account of what's going on? And that's, in fact, how you resolve Simpson's paradox. So let me explain how that works. So first of all, let me tell you why it appears like a paradox. And that's basically because, implicitly, I think we all imagine the causal structure to be the following, that the treatment might have a causal influence on recovery, and gender might have a causal influence on recovery. So it could be that, for instance, that men are more likely to recover from this illness than women are, regardless of whether they got the drug. And if that is indeed the causal structure, then there's actually no way to generate this kind of reversal, Because I could always just take the relative probability of being a man or a woman in this particular population, weight the second and third equations with those probabilities, and derive the opposite of the inequality that we have on the top. So there's no way to see these statistics with this causal structure. The resolution is that actually the causal structure is this one. So if you look at the statistical data, you'll note that it was more likely for men to get the drug than for women to get the drug. And so the idea here is that gender has an influence on treatment. Perhaps men are more likely to accept the treatment. And so the positive correlation we see overall can be explained as follows. So in this particular drug trial, men were more likely to get the drug than women were. Furthermore, for this particular illness, men are more likely to recover than women are, regardless of whether they got the drug. And therefore, if I tell you there's a member of the population, they received the drug, do you think that they're going to recover or not? Well, then you can reason as follows. If they received the drug, then they're more likely to have been a man. And if they're a man, they're more likely to recover. And therefore, they're more likely to recover if you tell me that they received the drug. So that's a positive correlation, but it's not by virtue of the causal effectiveness of the drug on recovery. In fact, for these statistics, the drug is actually contraindicated for recovery. It makes your rate of recovery less. So unless you've delved deeper into the causal structure, you don't know whether to take the drug or not. So what I would say is that the original understanding of Simpson's paradox, prior to people thinking of it in causal terms, was deficient because it conflated two concepts. It conflated the concept of causal influence with the concept of inference. The conditional probability of recovery given treatment, we want to know, is that a causal influence, or is it merely that learning about the treatment variable teaches me something about the recovery variable? And this is precisely what's wrong with the instrumentalist position in quantum theory as well. It too conflates inference and influence. So let me give you an example of that. So if I go back to my Bell experiment, and now I'm going to add labels to the two particles. So the left particle is A, the right particle is B. We all know that if I do a measurement over on the left particle and I register some outcome, the quantum formalism tells me to update the state I'm using, the quantum state, the state I'm using to describe B. And it's different bases in which I update it for different choices of settings over here. So one can ask, is that because there is a causal influence of the setting choice over on the left on the state of the system B? Or is it because this is the causal structure here, and learning the outcome X for a given setting teaches me something about A, and because A is common cause connected to B, it teaches me something about B, and the state update rule is really just that? So again, it's a question of whether it's just like the Simpson's paradox, whether it's a direct causal influence or a common cause. The quantum formalism doesn't tell us how we should interpret these updates. Let me give you another example of a quantum experiment, which I would say is difficult to understand causally. It's the quantum teleportation experiment. So what's the issue here? Well, let me first describe the experiment. We have three systems, A, B, and C. I'll take them to be two-level systems, qubits, for simplicity. We prepare B and C in an entangled state. We then come along to A and B, and we perform a measurement in a basis of entangled states. There's one of four possible outcomes for this measurement. And then the outcome is transmitted back to C, and one of four possible operations are done on C. And the overall effect of this is that whatever quantum state was prepared on A, that quantum state now becomes applicable as the final state of C once this protocol is done. But given that there's an infinite number of possibilities for this quantum state, you know, there's some real parameters in it, you would have expected that if I can transmit, if this is a physical state and I want to transmit it over here, then shouldn't I require an infinite number of bits to transmit that information from the left wing to the right wing? How can it be that I get away with just 2 bits of information transmitted? The common cause won't help because it knows nothing about the identity of that quantum state psi. Well, different ideas have been proposed for how you could explain this causally. One idea is that really there is an infinite amount of information that's somehow transmitted across the two wings, but it's just not in the classical channel that we use. Another idea that's been proposed is that maybe there are causal influences that propagate backward in time through the physical channel established by B and C. So this sort of thing. Now, the point I want to make here is that contra the instrumentalist, scientific theory is not just used for predicting the outcomes of some experiment that somebody gives you. A scientific theory is also used to try to figure out what's the next experiment I should do? And furthermore, how can I design a technology that will help me achieve some ends that I'm interested in? So in quantum information theory, for example, we know that quantum theory offers advantages over classical physics for tasks such as cryptography and communication and computation. And we'd like to devise protocols that allow us to do those tasks as well as possible. And if we have deficient understandings of what the causal structure underlying the quantum correlations are, then we'll be impeded in that task. So I think there's a very practical reason for trying to settle these sorts of issues. To give you one other example of a practical impact of understanding causal structure, this is very analogous to what we have in the Simpson's paradox case. You can use understanding of causal structure as a diagnostic tool for distinguishing Markovian from non-Markovian dynamics. So suppose you have a system S, which is evolving in your laboratory, and it may be interacting with an environment, and you're probing correlations between measurements that are done on the system at different times. And you're not sure whether the system evolves in a Markovian way, which means it depends only on the state at the previous time and not on the state at any time prior to that, or whether perhaps the environment has a memory of earlier states of the environment, or indeed the environment has a memory of earlier states of the system, which is what we call non-Markovian dynamics. Well, you'll note that this distinction is precisely the distinction between whether S1 and S2 are related purely by a direct cause channel, or whether they also have a common cause acting upon them. And so if you have general purpose tools for understanding what the causal structure for a given set of correlations are, you can help to solve this sort of problem, characterizing whether your dynamics is Markovian or not. And then finally, I would mention that we don't know how to apply quantum theory in all regimes. So for example, for gravitational phenomena, it's not clear precisely how we ought to apply the quantum formalism. And given that general relativity predicts that causal structure is dynamical, if you're wrong about the causal account of quantum correlations, and you try to extend the quantum formalism to the relativistic context, you're unlikely to be successful. So I believe that having a causal account of quantum correlations is actually quite critical for the progress of modern physics. And as one final example, I would say, there are regimes in physics where we don't really have statistical data. So in cosmology, we have a sample size of one, one universe. And so it seems to me that using experiments where we do have statistical data, if we can extract from those sort of the lesson that quantum theory has for us in terms of underlying causal structure, and then port that understanding of causal structure over to the cosmological context, we might be in a better position to make progress. All right, so I want to get on now to the problem with understanding quantum correlations causally. And so I'm going to go over a fundamental result in the foundations of quantum theory known as Bell's theorem. I'm going to provide it in a slightly different way from how you may have seen it before. And so I'm going to start with the algorithms that are used for the classical problem of inferring causal relations. So this is mostly pursued by researchers in the field of machine learning and statistics. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that formalism. So the basic idea of a mathematical model of underlying causal structure is what I'll call a causal model. And it consists of two parts. So there's a causal structure, which is a directed acyclic graph. The nodes are random variables. The directed edges represent that there's a direct causal influence from one variable to another. In addition to that, you have some statistical parameters. So for every node in the graph that has no causal parents, I specify the probability distribution over the values of that variable. And for every node that does have causal parents, I specify the probability distribution over the values of that variable, given all the possible values of its parents. And so you can easily prove that the joint distribution you expect to get over these variables for this causal model is just the product of these conditionals on the right. The causal inference problem, which is the one that people are focused on, is really the inverse problem. You are given some joint distribution over variables, which you've measured as statistical data, and you want to know which sorts of causal models could explain that observed data. And I should note that often your observed variables form a subset of the ones that are actually relevant in the underlying causal structure. Okay, so I'm actually not going to go into the details of these causal inference algorithms. They're quite nice and they're very sophisticated, but I just want to tell you about the principles underlying them. Because I think they're good principles and they should apply also for causal explanations of quantum correlations. So the first principle is that any statistical dependencies have to be explained causally. So that's already been encoded in this mathematical structure that I've told you about in the following way. So you'll notice that I demanded that the variables that were parents in, that had no parents in this graph were independently distributed. So I didn't allow, for example, W and S to be correlated. And the idea is that if I want to imagine that W, S are correlated, then I'm going to have to encode that in the causal structure by putting in, for example, a common cause or a direct cause between them. To explain the second principle to you, I'm going to just show a very simple example of a causal inference problem. So imagine you have three variables, A, B, C. You've observed some joint distribution over them. And you've noted that A is statistically independent of B in that distribution. So if I look at the marginal distribution, I find it factorizes. And there are no other independence relations in the distribution. So what's the natural causal structure that can explain this? Well, this causal structure will do it. So here, A and B have no parents, and they both are causes of C. So whatever parameters you add to this causal structure, you'll find that the overall distribution over A, B, and C is such that the marginal distribution on A and B factorizes. So it reproduces the independence we see. It's the natural explanation. But it turns out that there are other causal explanations that are logically possible. So here's an example of one. So here, C is a common cause for A and B, and B is a cause of A. So for generic values of the parameters in this model, I won't get independence between A and B. But if I choose them very carefully, for example, if I make it so that the common cause sets up a positive correlation and the direct cause sets up a negative correlation that precisely cancels the positive correlation, I can achieve independence between A and B. But that independence is achieved only by fine-tuning the parameters in the model. So only a set of measure zero of the values of the parameters in the model can explain this observation. And so by the lights of these causal inference algorithms, these are considered to be bad explanations of what's observed on the grounds that they had to be fine-tuned. And so these algorithms reject those as causal explanations. Okay, so that's the second principle that goes into these algorithms, the principle that our causal explanations should not be fine-tuned. Okay, let's ask now, what happens if I apply these kinds of ideas to the kinds of correlations we see in quantum theory? So I'm back to the Bell experiment. These are the correlations I described to you earlier. And the question now is, for these four variables, the two settings and two outcomes, what possible causal relations might hold among them that could do justice to these statistical correlations? So I'm actually going to use a slightly different set of statistical correlations. These are called the Popescu-Rohrlich box correlations. And they actually don't arise in quantum theory. But all the causal conclusions I can draw about them are precisely the same as the causal conclusions I can draw about the quantum correlations. And it's just going to make my life easier to be able to explain the possibilities for causal models in terms of these correlations. All right, so let's consider the first option, which is in many ways the most natural option, that there is some common cause which explains the correlations between X and Y. Because after all, I could do these two experiments, these two measurements, at space-like separation in the relativistic sense. And therefore, I wouldn't expect to have any causal influences propagating from the left-hand side to the right-hand side. So this is really the natural causal explanation. Turns out it's not possible as a causal explanation of these statistics. That is really the genius of Bell's theorem, the recognition that there are kinds of statistics that cannot be explained by these sorts of common cause models. So let me take you through why that's the case. So if you look at these correlations, you'll note that for the values of the settings 0, 0, 0, 1, and 1, 0, I get perfect correlation between the two outcomes. So X and Y are either 0, 0, or 1, 1 with equal probabilities. And in the last case, when the settings are both 1, I get perfect anti-correlation, 0 and 1, or 1 and 0 with equal probabilities. So there's no problem generating each of those kinds of correlations in this sort of model. So for the perfect correlations, I can make lambda a fair coin flip and just make X and Y copies of lambda. That'll get me here. And if I make X a copy of lambda and Y an anti-copy of lambda, I can get perfect anti-correlation. The problem is that whether Y is going to be a perfect copy or an anti-copy depends on both S and T. So for instance, if I imagine that T is equal to 1, so we're in the second or fourth row here, then whether X is correlated, whether Y is correlated with X or Y is anti-correlated with X depends on the value of S, whether it's 0 or 1. And the problem is that Y knows nothing about the value of S. There is no causal pathway from S to Y. And for that reason, this causal model cannot generate these correlations, so it's ruled out. Okay, so then you go looking for other possibilities, and the natural one then is to imagine that Y does learn about the value of S by virtue of there being a causal influence from S to Y. That can certainly generate these sorts of correlations. But again, by the lights of these algorithms, this is a bad explanation. Why? Because it's fine-tuned. So it turns out that these types of correlations, and in fact, all quantum correlations that you can see in this kind of experiment, have the property that the variable S is statistically independent of the variable Y. The reason is that if it weren't, I could use it to send signals faster than the speed of light. I could manipulate the value of S. That would lead to changes in the distribution over values of Y, and then I could send signals in that way. And so, given the independence of S and Y, if there is a causal influence from S to Y, then the only way to secure that independence is to ensure that the parameters that I add to this model are fine-tuned in such a way that I can get the independence that we observe. Okay, so you go looking for other causal models. Here is something that people have sometimes suggested as the superdeterminism loophole for Bell's theorem, which is that it could be that the setting on the left has a common cause with, for example, the outcome on the right. And that certainly can generate these kinds of correlations. The problem, again, is that it requires fine-tuning. So any common cause between S and Y generically would tend to make them correlated. And so if I observe them to be statistically independent, I need to ensure that the parameters in this model are fine-tuned to do it. So it turns out that essentially all the proposals that people have made for how you might get a causal account of the Bell correlations turn out to be fine-tuned in this sort of way. So you can go looking for other kinds of options that people might not have considered. So really, out of all possibilities for how these things might be connected causally, arbitrarily complicated, you go looking, and what you find is that none of them work. Every one of them either cannot generate the correlations that we have here, or they can do it, but they have to be fine-tuned. Okay, so that's one way of thinking about Bell's theorem. And let me just summarize for you how the argument has gone. The principles that went into these causal models were that statistical dependencies need to be explained causally, no fine-tuning. We got a contradiction with these observed correlations. As I said, I could run that same argument for the actual quantum correlations, and therefore I get a contradiction with quantum theory and with the experiments that validated quantum theory. So in the face of this contradiction, which of these assumptions should we abandon? So I tried to argue in the beginning that the assumption that statistical dependencies need to be explained causally is a very useful one. You know, the negation of that, which is a kind of instrumentalism, I don't think will lead to progress. And this assumption is something that's essentially acknowledged across scientific disciplines, that this is really what science is about. So I'm very reluctant to try to abandon it in the quantum sphere alone. That strikes me as somehow wrong. The second assumption is also a principle that you can apply across scientific disciplines. Generically speaking, fine-tuned explanations are considered bad explanations. I see no reason to drop it in the quantum sphere alone. And furthermore, even though there are kinds of fine-tuning that are perhaps a bit less objectionable, so for example, if you show that the fine-tuned distribution is the fixed point of some equilibration process, well, then it's not so bad. But all of those sorts of solutions that have been proposed have the unfortunate feature that when you're not at the fixed point of this equilibration process, then you can send signals faster than the speed of light, and you do complete violence to the theory of relativity. So my impression is that we shouldn't really be abandoning that assumption either. So what do you do when you have a no-go theorem and you're not willing to abandon any of the assumptions on your list? You go looking for other assumptions that are implicit in the argument. And in this case, you find such an assumption, which is that this whole framework of causal models assumed that the unobserved nodes, the ones that were acting as the common causes, but which we weren't directly measuring, were described by variables that take some value in a set of possibilities. And the inferences that I used to compute relative frequencies in these sorts of models, those inferences are all described by the rules of classical probability theory. So this is actually a substantive assumption. And in my view, it's actually the one that's most likely to be wrong. Okay, so I want to tell you a little bit about what happens if you take this route and try to give up on this assumption. And so what it corresponds to is trying to define an intrinsically quantum generalization of the notion of a causal model. So first of all, over here on the left, the old notion of a causal model allowed for these unobserved nodes, well, it had these unobserved nodes as classical variables, and we update that to a kind of quantum variable. So this doesn't have to take a value in some set of possibilities any longer. And I'm going to denote these quantum variables now by circles and the classical variables by triangles. But the more important innovation is that the statistical parameters, which were really about inference, about how you should propagate your information about one variable to another variable, previously they were these conditional probabilities, and they are now replaced by a generalization of conditional probability. So what we have over here are operators. And so this, for example, we call it a quantum conditional state, and it's an operator on a Hilbert space defined by these variables. And it is really meant to be a non-commutative generalization of the notion of conditional probability. And so in this formalism, there is a way of computing the statistics of x and y given s and t using these parameters. It has this sort of form, where the sum over the hidden parameter is replaced by a trace. And what you can show is that in this case, you can reproduce precisely the set of quantum correlations that you can achieve in these sorts of experiments, whereas here you cannot because of Bell's theorem. Okay, so let me say a few words about how this changes your view of what's going on causally in these sorts of experiments. So it's really very conservative about the causal structure. That most natural causal structure that doesn't do any violence to relativity theory is the one that's deemed to really be describing this experiment. And so if we remember back the question about how should I think about the collapse of the quantum state of B upon learning the outcomes of a measurement over here on A, in this sort of approach, I think of that collapse process in the same way that I would think about Bayesian conditioning of a probability distribution. I start out with some knowledge of B, and then upon learning what the outcome of this measurement is and knowing what the setting was, I update that knowledge based on the fact that learning X and knowing S teaches me something about A. And because A is common cause connected to B, that teaches me something about B. So it's precisely like the explanation we found for the Simpson paradox types of correlations. It's an inference rather than an influence. But let me be clear that it's not enough to just state that one should interpret quantum collapses as Bayesian updating. One needs to prove that you can really make this work as a calculus for computing the correlations that we see in quantum experiments. And so in particular, if we had the classical scenario where A and B were classical variables, this would be a probability distribution over B being updated to some new probability distribution, and that new probability distribution would have to be computed using rules of classical probability theory. So what's given in that problem is a joint distribution over A and B, and a conditional probability of X given S and A, and then you need to convert that. So the first thing you would do is you'd say, okay, what do I learn about A from knowing X? Well, that's an instance of Bayesian inversion. There's a formula in classical probability for how to do that. And then I need to know, well, given that new knowledge of A, how should I update my knowledge of B? Then I need to compute the conditional probability of B given A. And there's a formula for obtaining that from the joint. I just take the joint over the marginal on A. And then I can propagate, I can use my conditional probability of A given X and S and the conditional probability of B given A to compute the conditional probability of B given S and X. So there's a formalism for all of that, and we need to have an analog of everything in that formalism. So we do have such an analog. So what's given is a joint state on A and B and some conditional state of X given S and A, which essentially describes the set of measurements you're doing. And then we have analogs of all these different elements that I just mentioned in the classical case, a notion of Bayesian inversion, a notion of a conditional from a joint, and a formula for how to propagate your beliefs. This star product is a particular operator product. I won't go into the details. It's non-commutative, non-associative. And the real challenge here is to define a framework that has all these elements and allows us to compute the correct quantum statistics. Okay, so we have this framework. It works well in a large number of experimental scenarios. So for instance, what it says about the quantum teleportation scenario is that the causal structure is actually, again, the very conservative one, which is just that there's a common cause and two bits of information transmitted causally from the left to the right wing. And the way to understand that is that in this sort of framework, the state psi is really a state of incomplete information. And what happens in the teleportation protocol is the transfer of the applicability of that state of information from the system A to the system C. So roughly speaking, the particular choice of preparation and measurement tells me that whatever I believe about B, I should believe the same thing about C. They're perfectly correlated. And if I get the right outcome of this measurement, it tells me that whatever I believe about A, I should believe exactly the same thing about B. And so when this whole thing is done, it says, well, whatever you believed about A, you ought to believe the same thing about C. And it doesn't matter how difficult it is to describe that state of knowledge. I didn't need any communication to transfer its applicability from here to here. Okay, there are, however, certain scenarios where our framework doesn't work. So this is an example. It's a pre and post selection. So you have a preparation procedure, a measurement, followed by a second measurement, and your task is to make inferences about the intermediate measurement based on the later and the earlier ones. And this is the natural causal structure that would correspond to that, and the framework simply doesn't work. Now, we have modifications of the framework that can capture this, and that modification also has some problems with other scenarios. So this is ongoing work. It's still just a research program, but I am hopeful that it can be made to work for any causal structure. So you'll have to stay tuned for that. But I told you in the beginning that there were practical dividends for understanding the causal relations underlying quantum correlations. So I would be remiss if I didn't tell you a little bit about the practical dividends of this notion of a quantum causal model. So one thing we noticed was that for these two very simple causal scenarios, where we just have two systems that are either direct cause or common cause related, in both cases, we could write down a conditional state, rho b given a, but we noticed that they had slightly different mathematical properties. So in addition to the mathematical properties they had in common, in the common cause case, this operator was a positive operator, so all its eigenvalues were positive. But in the direct cause case, its partial transpose was a positive operator. And so we reasoned that if I do measurements on this pair of systems, and if the correlations could teach me something about which of these two conditional states I have, then I could maybe hope to distinguish these kinds of situations. So in follow-up work with other collaborators, we showed that this is indeed the case. So you can, there's a certain task, a causal inference task, which I'll describe to you, where quantum mechanics allows you to solve that task better than you could in a classical theory. So the task is this. There's two systems, which I'll call A and B, that are embedded in a circuit. A is prior to B in time, but you don't know precisely what circuit they're embedded in. So it could be this one, where A is prepared, and then it's the input of some gate, and B is its output. Or it could be this one over here, where A and B are prepared together in some correlated state, and then A is thrown away and B is output from the circuit. So essentially, you don't know what's inside the dash box region, and you'd like to try to find out based on probing the correlations between the outcomes of measurements that you perform on A and B. And so this corresponds to really distinguishing whether A and B are direct cause or common cause related. So let's consider what would happen in a classical theory. So here I've added in my probes, my measurements on A and B, which could have different settings and variables describing the outcomes. So in both cases, just like in the Simpson's paradox, I can expect to see correlations between the outcomes of these two measurements. And I can think about it in the following sort of way. Let's start over here on the right. Well, the measurement here, its outcome X, teaches me something about the state of the system that was fed into that device. So it teaches me something about A. But by virtue of the common cause between A and B, that teaches me something about B. And B teaches me something about Y. So I'm going to get a correlation between X and Y. And over here on the left, X is going to teach me something about the output of this measurement, which I'm calling A prime. And A prime teaches me something about B by virtue of their connection through this gate. And B teaches me something about Y. So again, I expect to see correlations between X and Y. And the question is the scope of possibilities for those correlations on the left and the right the same or not? Well, the scope of possibilities for the conditional probability of B given A is exactly the same on these two sides. So it turns out if you ask, what ways are there of updating my knowledge across one of these direct cause connections, the answer is any conditional probability could hold there. But similarly here, you can get any conditional probability as a way of updating your knowledge across a common cause. And so if your probing scheme at A has the feature that the outcome teaches you exactly the same thing about the output as it teaches you about the input, so your conditional probability for the output is the same as your conditional probability for the input, then you expect that the scope of correlations in these two cases will be precisely the same, and you can't tell the two apart. So this sort of property holds for lots of different classical measurement schemes, in particular the passive observation scheme, where I just learn the value of A and I don't disturb it at all, has this feature. And that's why, you know, if I just saw a correlation between treatment and recovery in a drug trial and I didn't have access to any other variables, I would not know whether that drug was effective for treatment or whether maybe it was entirely due to some common cause like gender. There's just no way to tell those two apart. But in the quantum case, there is. In the quantum case, as I mentioned, the kinds of conditional states you can have for B given A across a direct cause channel are different from those you can have across a common cause channel. And therefore, if you're looking at schemes that have this symmetry property, where what you learn about the input is precisely the same as what you learn about the output, then still you expect to get different possibilities for the correlations between X and Y in these two experiments. And so you should expect to sometimes be able to distinguish these two circuits. And so we decided that we would do an experiment to test this prediction of the quantum causal model framework. And the experiment used the two photonic modes as our systems A and B, and in fact the polarization degree of freedom of those modes as our qubits. And we controlled between the two causal structures. So the way we did that was we took our mode A, we prepared it in a maximally entangled state with some other mode E, and then we either just threw E away and applied identity so that A became B, just goes through an identity gate, or we swapped them, in which case A and B are now common cause connected because they've been prepared in this maximally entangled state. And so the maximally entangled state was prepared using parametric down conversion, and this controlled operation, either identity or swap, was achieved by a Sagnac interferometer where you could control the relative phase of the clockwise and counterclockwise photons. And then we did our measurements on A and B using polarization filters. What we decided to do to make things interesting is that for various different runs of the experiment, we had probabilistic mixtures of these two causal scenarios with some relative probability P, and we varied that probability from being totally direct cause to totally common cause. And the question is, when you look at the correlations that you see, can you extract that parameter? Can you figure out how much common cause and how much direct cause there was? And if this was a classical theory that governed this experiment, the answer would be no. But in fact, what we see is that indeed the best fit of our data to a quantum causal model allows us to extract the p-value that we prepared in the experiment to pretty good accuracy. So what I think is interesting about this experiment and this theoretical work is that it shows that there's a quantum advantage for a task that's very unlike the kinds of tasks that we've seen quantum advantages for in the past. Those tasks have tended to be information processing tasks. This is a causal inference task, and I'm hopeful that because it's about causation, it might have more pertinence to problems in physics. Also, I should mention that that problem I mentioned at the very beginning, which was sort of a very practical example of how you should use a causal account of correlations, this result I just described to you is obviously applicable here, because what it says is that in the scenarios where I have purely a direct cause structure, I should expect certain characteristics for the correlations I can see for the system at two times. Whereas in these cases where I have some component of common cause, I should expect a component of these different sorts of correlations. So we're currently working on using these tools I mentioned to you to actually develop a diagnostic for determining whether some unknown dynamics in an experiment are Markovian or not. All right, so let me just wrap up. I tried to persuade you that it's important for us to have a causal understanding beneath the quantum correlations. I tried to tell you something about the problem of achieving such a causal account that's implied by Bell's theorem. And I give you one idea for how you might try to overcome that problem and get a robust and natural causal explanation of the quantum correlations we see. And that was this framework of quantum causal models, which is still being developed. And I would characterize that approach as being essentially conservative on the causal structure and innovative on the mathematical theory of inference that connects that causal structure to the correlations that we see. Finally, I would note that the classical tools for causal inference that I mentioned at the beginning are only about 20, 25 years old, and they haven't really been taken up by researchers in the fields that make use of statistical data, so fields like medicine, epidemiology, genetics, economics. But slowly, they're starting to be used. And I really think that it's going to lead to revolutionary progress in those fields, being able to distinguish inference from influence. And in quantum foundations, it's only been a few years where people have tried to apply the insights from causal inference to the foundational problems of quantum theory. And it's a very exciting field to be in. There's new results every month coming out. And I think here, too, it's going to lead to great progress in our understanding of quantum mechanics. So thanks for your attention.
So any questions for Rob? Can you get from here and then repeat the question?
I guess.
No, but we have here first. Okay, so let's go there first.
So you mentioned the no-go theorem, and kind of to solve that, you alter the rules of probability theory. Could post-selection inform that, or what could post-selection do for that? Because I think that's one way that people think about quantum mechanics often.
Yeah, so from the perspective of these framework of causal inference, post-selection is really about inference. So if I, for example, have a sequence of measurements and I learn the outcome of the last one and I want to update my probabilities about what the likely outcome of the first one was, classical probability theory allows me to do that. It allows me to say, here's what you can infer about the likelihood of different outcomes earlier based on what you learned about things later on. And like in Simpson's paradox, you should not confuse that updating of your knowledge of earlier times as meaning that there's a causal influence from the future to the past. And I think in the quantum context, where it's even harder to disentangle these notions of influence and inference, many people have been tempted to say that a post-selection should be thought of as having a causal influence on the past and hope to try to understand quantum theory in that way. My own impression is that it's more likely that we should really just think of it as a species of inference. And so the kind of framework I showed you would take post-selection in that sort of way, as a way of updating our knowledge about the past.
So in the experiment that you were describing there, you had this condition of information symmetry?
Yes.
So is that, it seems like a bit of a fine-tuning there. Would you agree with that when you're running the experiments or to enforce that condition?
It's certainly possible that in the actual experiment, that idealization is not achieved. But from a theoretical standpoint, you know, the closer you get to that ideal, the more you expect to see a deviation between quantum and classical. So I really think of it as a delimiting kind of the scope of ideal classical probing schemes where you don't expect to be able to distinguish common cause from direct cause. And then that's really, so we call those the observational schemes. And so what we really needed to do to prove that there was a quantum advantage is to say, what's the quantum analog of that set of probing schemes? And so this information symmetry property can be applied just as well in the quantum context as it has in the classical context. And the real reason is that the kind of poster child for observational schemes, namely passive observation, there just isn't a quantum analog of that. You know, there's no quantum measurement where you could say all it does is teach you the value of some variable. That's right.
Hello. So you addressed the issue that the fine-tuning would not be a problem if we look at the theory as a sort of equilibrium of a deeper theory, as a fixed point of
yes.
a deeper theory.
Yes.
But you seem to not like that option. Is it that unlikely that there's a deeper theory and quantum mechanics is just somehow the equilibrization of that theory and the deeper theory might allow faster than light travel and these things? Is that unlikely for you?
Well, it's certainly a logical possibility. And in particular, you know, Antony Valentini has proposed a version of the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation of quantum mechanics that has exactly this feature, that it's only in some equilibrium limit that you expect to get precisely the quantum correlations. And if you're away from that limit, you expect to be able to send superluminal signals. But of course, in that theory, there's a preferred rest frame. There's a notion of simultaneity. And so really, all of the structure of relativity doesn't apply. And so I personally think that as long as there's other options on the table, that it's worth pursuing those options. I'm not enthused by that kind of possibility. So the framework of classical causal models that I reviewed is a way of, I would say, generalizing the notion of a hidden variable model. So it includes hidden variable models as particular instances of causal models. And people argue about whether one of the assumptions of Bell's theorem is, you know, there exist hidden variables. So people often will summarize the assumptions of Bell's theorem as realism and locality. And some people think that realism means there are hidden variables. Other people want to say, oh no, it's much broader than just saying there are hidden variables. It just says that there's, you know, something real out there. So the formulation I gave you, I think, overcomes some of these problems, because realism was always a very nebulous sort of assumption. And it's now been replaced by the assumption that when you see statistical correlations, you should try to explain them causally, however you make that causal explanation work. And to my mind, the anti-realists, the people I know who reject realism, often, I think, are really just rejecting the idea that correlations do need to be explained causally. But the quantum causal models that I described were not hidden variable models, because I'm replacing that common cause, which was a variable that could take on some value in a set, with a quantum system, so really an algebra of operators. So one question I didn't answer with these quantum causal models is that if we're supposed to think of these operators as describing inference and incomplete states of information about systems, then is it possible to imagine that as knowledge of something deeper, akin to, you know, the hidden variables in the classical case? And that's a really tough question. My own view is that perhaps we can make it work where the thing that is deeper is not hidden variables, but just really causal structure, a bare directed acyclic graph describing causal relations. But that's just purely speculation on my part.